that have been presented or have been forwarded and posted in our packets. It's my bad. I apologize. We didn't have those ready in time, but they are coming. And then we typically approve the minutes, but it was pointed out that we still needed some information in terms of being specific about the amendments that were offered at the last minutes meeting. So we'll hold off on approving the minutes until the next time we convene. With that, we have a presentation from the Pulse Board to get us started. And so I'm going to ask Mr. Gove to come on forward and give us his testimony and get us going. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Nate Gove of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, commonly referred to as the Pulse Board. And I just wanted to provide an update to the committee on the Pulse Board's efforts to improve the quality of law enforcement investigations concerning sexual assault crimes. The board, since last September, has been working through a work group of our standards committee to develop a model policy. Chief Stephanie, referring to my right, of the Crystal Police Department, chaired that work group. It had at least 14 members, advocacy, law enforcement, large and small, investigators, to develop what we feel is an appropriate policy. And it's sort of the what's expected. And so I'm happy to report that it was passed unanimously by our board last Thursday at our board meeting, and it's been sent out to all of the approximately 430 law enforcement agencies and their chief law enforcement officers yesterday. And I verified that with Chief Revering as it went through. It's also on our website. The specific areas of it, really, it's about a 10-page policy. It really focuses on three important areas: that this is a victim-centered response to this terrible crime. It involves how law enforcement communicates to victims. It also focuses on trauma, that there's informed interviewing techniques, and certainly elements of an appropriate investigative response, realizing that these are complex cases. There's a lot of nuances and variations, a lot of officer and detective discretion. But it's our view, and the board voted unanimously, that it should be a mandated policy. And I've read it numerous times, and nothing jumps out at me that says a small agency can't do this. We're talking about identifying and collecting evidence, interviewing suspects and witnesses, and certainly there may be instances of cases that need additional assistance from other agencies. That's not uncommon now with complex cases. The policy starts out really reinforcing that it's underreported, that this crime of sexual assault are underreported to law enforcement. The goal is to improve the victim experience in reporting this, so that more people are encouraged to report and victims are maintain engagement with the criminal justice system, which can lead to successful prosecutions, holding suspects accountable, and public safety. The bill has a number of definitions. It is intertwined with requirements concerning mandated reporting, vulnerable adults, the domestic of violence policy and statutes that apply, but talks about procedures for communications personnel, of which the Pulse Board doesn't regulate, but they have a role in the types of information that they may in certain instances want to make sure that they're communicating to the victim, which would be helpful for responding officers. It talks about the initial officer response and what's expected. Connecting early on in the investigation, the victim with local victim advocacy as soon as possible. Understanding that it's important on what services are available. Ensure that the victim survivor understands they can go to a designated facility for a forensic medical exam. It talks about victim interviews. And understanding that in this type of a terrible crime, it's not always investigated from a linear standpoint, that it's important on how to elicit the best memories from the victim at various points in the investigation to gather detail on what occurred. That victims, due to the trauma they've experienced, may have a great deal of difficulty remembering the incidents in a real chronological fashion and may remember additional details in the weeks and days to follow the assault. We talk about special considerations, minors and vulnerable adults, and as I touched on, domestic abuse victims. We understand that there are a number of areas that if there are changes into certain state statutes that we may have to update this policy, but that's not uncommon with other policies that we update. We talk about protecting victims' rights, evidence collection, considerations for evidence collection, the sexual assault medical forensic examination, contacting and interviewing suspects, and some real basic running background checks. You know, considering if there's going that interviews with suspects should be done in person if at all possible, but there are instances when a monitored call by law enforcement to the victim to a suspect, especially a known suspect, has been very successful in the prosecution. So, again, we have a section, the final two sections on what is the role of the supervisor, and talking about a case review and a case summary, so that agencies have a handle on case dispositions. What are the decisions being made? The board, we don't want to weigh into subjective decision judgments. Experienced investigators, their supervisors, executives in those law enforcement agencies are in a position to do that. I'm aware that there are a number of agencies that have a far more detailed policy currently in place, such as the St. Paul Police Department, based on their own sexual assault investigative unit, their protocols, the available resources within Ramsey County. So we set this as what the a base appropriation is, with expectation, with reasonable detail, realizing that we do need to realize that 75% of Minnesota's 430 law enforcement agencies are 25 officers or less. I highly doubt they have a dedicated sexual assault investigation unit. So general case investigators. But this is something that we have put together, and I just am very appreciative of the work of Chief Revering and advocacy who gave the Post Board a lot of input on this, a great deal of input, so that we came up with something that we think is reasonable and workable and can be implemented.
Thank you, Director Golvin. Congratulations on the recent decision of voting on the Pulse Board to move this forward, and then moving it forward as quickly as you did. And members, I think you did say that the policy is now on your website?
Yes, on our homepage.
Okay, very good. So we can go there and review it as well. I know that Representative O'Neill has a question, but I'm wondering, Representative O'Neill, perhaps we should hear from the chief first. Is that okay? All right, very well. Welcome, chief, to committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, representatives. I really appreciate being here today. As Mr. Goh said, my name is Stephanie Revering. I'm the police chief with the Crystal Police Department. And in January of 2018, Governor Dayton appointed me to the vacant one-year spot for the Post Board, and I've been sitting on the board since. At the July 2018 Post Board meeting, Chair Tim Bildsoe directed the board to convene a working group on sexual assault investigations to develop a model policy, and I was asked to chair that working group. We had approximately 14 key stakeholders at the table from August 2018 through December 2018. having 6 meetings and several email and phone conversations. Those key stakeholders included chief law enforcement officers from both mid-size and small agencies, command staff from large and small agencies, an investigator from Anoka County, who is also the president of the Sex Crimes Association, and several advocates who were instrumental in drafting this policy. We discussed at great length the need to ensure the model policy would fit into all size agencies, especially, as Mr. Goh said, since 70% of Minnesota police agencies have fewer than 10 officers. We also discussed the importance of the following. Number one, recognizing the seriousness of sexual assault and taking a victim-centered approach to investigate these crimes. Number two, having an advocate present when possible during the investigation. Number three, having supervisors review sexual assault reports and making sure necessary steps are taken during the initial response and throughout the entire investigation. And finally, number four, having a supervisor ensure cases are reviewed on an ongoing basis. And that sums up what the group, the working group settled on, and I'm here for any questions that you may have.
Terrific. Thank you, Chief, and thank you for your leadership on this important issue.
Thank you.
As well. We do have a question from Representative O'Meara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So glad to have you both here today. It's something that I've been looking forward to, the presentation, and I'm going to ask some specific questions, and maybe you've covered it at a higher level, but I was just wondering, when you're doing the trauma-informed interviewing, did you talk about the fact that victims actually do change their stories? And so that, you know, you talked about the timeline. It doesn't always match what other crime victims might tell. You know, it's like, oh, they X, Y, and Z, but maybe they'll go in X and Y, and then they kind of come back. And it sounds like they're changing their story, which is sometimes a hindrance to prosecution, because I've literally heard we can't prosecute this because the victim changed her story. And victims change their stories. That's sort of the nature of the crime and the trauma. So if you could address that, and I have a couple other quick questions. Were you specific also in interviewing outcry witnesses? I didn't hear that specifically, but maybe that was a discussion to make sure that anyone that they reached out to, maybe in moments after or a day after or 2 days after the trauma happened, the crime happened, that they, you know, told in greater detail maybe to their best friend or their mother or whoever it was, that might be a really crucial part of the interview process is the outcry witnesses. And then the last point, I was just making sure that you've covered all these points, is that they make a specific and sorted effort to make sure that they're gathering textbook messages or Facebook messages or any communication between the victim and the offender, because there's lots and lots of evidence usually in something like that, because most of those crimes are with familial people. Those are the three things I wanted to make sure that at least you talked about in some level and it becomes part of that model policy.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Excellent questions. Chief Reverie.
Yes, Representative O'Neill, I'm going to start with number three first because that's the one that's easiest for me to answer. Yes is the answer to that regarding the text messages. That's something that the advocates brought up actually right away, and that is in the policy that we will make sure that we receive all text messages, anything related to social media at all, and anything related to actually computer forensic or anything else. And then your second question, the outcry witnesses. So that was discussed also as well regarding the fact that other witnesses may not be present, obviously, when we come to the scene, and that was discussed. And it is, I believe, in there, and I will take a few minutes to look at it, but it does discuss that we need to ask further witnesses that were on scene or not on scene regarding the crime itself. And then your first question regarding
the change,
we definitely talked about that. That's something that that I believe is also in there, and I can point it out to you as soon as I can look at it. But I'm positive that all three things that you addressed, we certainly talked about at this working group meeting and addressed in the policy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Director Gove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, yes, under the initial officer response, it is specifically directs the officer to attempt to interview potential witnesses and anyone the victim told about the sexual assault. And in addition, it does list under interviewing the victim specifically relevant communication through social media, email, text messages, or any other forms of communication.
Very well. We have a question from, you're done, Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Thank you. We have a question from Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at Section G, Number 2. The officer should not be present during any part of the exam, including the medical history. If you have a traumatized victim that has developed rapport and makes the request that they stay, should the officer still leave, or is there something I'm missing?
No, if they do develop, oh, I'm sorry, Representative, if they do decide to, if they have a rapport with that officer and they want the officer to stay, they certainly can. This is just saying that.
It doesn't prohibit it.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Cassidy. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I want to thank you for putting this basic model policy together. Going through reading this brings back memories from about 15 years ago when my department put one even more comprehensive this together. Our department works with the county attorney's office, with the victim services advocate, and we put a very detailed policy together that works very well. I see that you did have in there talking with and working with the victim's rights advocates, but I didn't notice anything about the county attorney's office, because they are valuable for information as well, helping getting prosecution put together better, because they might see some information that's missing that the investigating officer might be able to go find.
Chief Reverie?
Representative, we did talk about this actually at the working group regarding prosecution and whether or not we should put this into the policy. However, I think if I remember correctly, the reason why we didn't is because we feel this was a model policy for law enforcement agencies, not for the prosecution piece. And so for us as law enforcement, we deal with the prosecution piece afterwards, after the investigation. I mean, during as well, obviously, during the investigation, but more so while we're dealing with the victim during the investigation, we're not necessarily dealing with prosecution. So I remember talking about this at the meetings, but we decided not to have anything with regards to prosecution in the policy.
Chair Johnson?
Chair Mariani, thank you for that. But from my own experience, it is very good to have the county attorney's office involved in this and helping, because if we don't know what they're looking for to get the proper information to put a good case together, it's very difficult for them to put a case together on the backside. I know in the cases that I worked, my goal was to put a case together that never went to court because of that the perpetrator pleaded guilty. We need to do everything we can to help these victims, because they're a victim when the crime occurs. They're a victim when it's reported, because of the very detailed questions that the investigator has to ask these individuals. They're very victimized again when they have to prepare to go to court, should it end up going to court. They're victimized again on the stand. And they're victimized every time there's a continuance of that trial. So I hope we can get the best cases together so they do not have to be victimized again.
Representative O'Neill, is this on this point, I take it? I thought so. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so one other piece that I've heard through victims is sometimes the law enforcement doesn't actually go to the scene of the crime and collect evidence. Is that part of the policy? In addition to, I appreciate what former Chair Johnson was talking about with the coordination with prosecution, because that's incredibly important. But one piece that seems to be missing is maybe the evidence collection and returning to the scene and taking pictures and bedding and clothing.
No. That.
Chief Reverie. And Chief, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
You are, sir. Yep.
Very
you
well. Are. Chief Reverie.
Representative, I believe that is on page 9 under letter I, forensic examination and or the collection of evidence from the suspect. We know as law enforcement it's imperative to make sure that we have evidence, and we certainly will go to the scene of the incident and make sure that we do collect all of the evidence, and that is in the policy.
Very well. We have a question from Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as Representative Johnson brought it up, I just want to endorse his point about the handoff between the importance of a close collaboration between law enforcement and prosecution, because I feel like sometimes I have found in my work that, that law enforcement is sort of making guesses as to what's going to be helpful for the case, and it's so helpful to have that close relationship. And I assume that I'm sure the County Attorneys Association and county attorneys are aware of this policy, and if they have concerns or thoughts, they'll speak up. It looks really good to me. I have a question, though, that maybe steps back just one notch, which is about these model policies in general. So I was prosecuting domestic violence cases for quite a while, and I think had even been elected here, I'm embarrassed to say, before realizing that the Post Board even had a domestic violence model policy. And I think that many of us had the reaction of saying, boy, it's amazing there wouldn't have been this policy, and so it's good to have it. And we'll be hearing the bill, I know, shortly about implementing a policy like this. But in the absence of that, what is the impact of these policies? Because I think sometimes I'm looking at it from the outside thinking, well, we've got this list of policies, but sort of are they really doing anything? Are they really being used in any concrete, practical way? So any thoughts on that, either Chief or Mr. Gove?
Director Gove.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I can tell you that I received far more phone calls from chiefs and sheriffs than I have in the past about, hey, do you have that policy ready? Can I see it? We already have one. I want to make sure we're getting this. And it's like, hey, we're trying to get it put together. But it's on their radar, and they are responsible for that. They certainly want to ensure that victims receive justice. I mean, they're in the business of public safety, and I think they do have an impact. Some may disagree with me, but it's as long as we can craft a policy that can be implemented by the smallest agencies, when we know the majority of agencies are small. And agencies are certainly, based on their resources and staffing and call volume, are free to have even more in-depth. So it's something that we have a number of model policies and mandated policies, and obviously this one is critically important.
Mr. Chair, so it sounds like from what Director Gove is saying that actually maybe one ancillary benefit on top of all the other benefits of this effort is that I suspect there may be some agencies that are going to look at the other model policies and say, boy, it didn't occur to us that, you know, that, boy, we should look at some of these other policies, some other areas as well that you have, if they hadn't been focused on it before. So thank you both and to the working group for your work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Our Vice Chair, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for your testimony. And this is great to see this. I'm just curious because I would say that best practices are really created every day and they evolve. So while this is really great, I would love to know what the interaction between departments looks like so that this policy does evolve, because I'm sure there's other departments that are experiencing in working with victims more than other departments. Some have more officers than others. So I would love to know what that relationship looks like between the departments.
Chair Reverie? Chief
Reverie. That's okay. Mr. Chair and ma'am.
Started with a CH.
It's okay. I would have answered anyway. So just so I'm understanding you correctly, you want to know the inner workings of departmental, how we interact with other departments?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, so in terms of geographically, obviously, all the officers are spread out very differently. There's this policy. They get this policy at their office. And I'm always thinking about, like, how logistically, like Representative Pinto said, how does this actually work when it gets into their hands?
Sure.
I'm wondering, are there ways for officers to collaborate on best practices that they're seeing in the field outside of just getting a piece of paper with telling them, this is the best policy? I want to know, what does it actually look like when people are talking to each other and saying, hey, one officer says to another, hey, you know what, I did this, and this worked well, and we really did the victim justice here. And so what are the inner workings of the departments?
Reverend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there are several counties in the state that have SMART teams, and those SMART teams actually work collaboratively with certain agencies throughout the state and certain cities. My city, for example, we have a DART team, which is very similar to SMART. It has to do with domestic abuse response team. But we collectively, many, many cities in the state have mutual aid agreements and work collectively with other cities. And so if there is a crime, that a horrific crime is this that occurs in one city and maybe they don't have the personnel to handle it, they may farm this investigation out to the county, and the county may be dealing with it if they don't have the personnel. So we do work very well together, the law enforcement agencies, knowing that there's other resources out there.
Very well. Are there any other questions? All right. Chief Reverie and Director Gove, thank you for being here today. But more importantly, thank you for your leadership in the development of this model policy for our law enforcement community in the state of Minnesota. I was very struck, Director Gove, by your response to the fact that your phone was ringing with chiefs from across the state calling and asking, for this guidance and when it was going to come out. And so clearly, it seems to me that there's an important awareness and a stepping up to be held accountable on the part of our law enforcement community. We would expect nothing less. Terrific, important that we hold perpetrators accountable, that we don't let failures in our system to get in the way of that. That we support and that we respond to victims in an appropriate time. There's that old saying about justice delayed is justice denied. And so I hope that what we're doing is moving closer to full pursuit of justice here. And I want to thank you again for both of your leadership in this effort.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we're going to move to House File 327. That's Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller, I believe the motion here is for House File 327 to be referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Mr. Chair, I thought that was the other House file. I thought this one was going to be recommended to layover for...
Representative Mueller, you are absolutely correct. Yeah. Yeah, my CA and I are not having the best day today. But we're going to get in sync before too long. My bad. Representative Mueller, yeah, your motion is to have this bill laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That's correct. I thought you were trying to trip me up as a first timer, so I'm glad
I
passed that test. I also passed the bringing a treat test, so I've got the cookies that are moving around for members and staff. But yes, that is my motion for House File 327 to be laid over for possible inclusion with the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Please proceed.
Yep, and then I also have a motion for the Delete Everything Amendment, DE2, to be adopted.
Members, you should have the DE2 with you. And so Representative Mueller amends her motion to, or actually moves to, the delete all amendment DE2. And this will put it in the shape, the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Mueller, the bill is before us in the form that you wish it to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this bill really came about also as a result of the Denied Justice series that was in the Star Tribune, and I think that many of us were shocked and disheartened by what that revealed. And on the flip side of that, we were happy to know that the Post Board already started to work on the policy that we just heard about. And I want to thank Mr. Gove and Chief Revering for being here today and describing that policy, but also for all of the work you did and how inclusive you were in keeping in mind the different sizes of the agencies, but especially victims and survivors in that, in the advocacy programs also, which we'll be hearing from today. So basically what this bill does is it requires local law enforcement agencies to adopt either this model policy or one that really meets the same standards that are in the Post Board policy. Now, this one also requires that local law enforcement consult with advocates and other organizations. And just to address Representative Johnson's question that you had about this, there's nothing that would preclude local law enforcement from talking to their county attorneys about that and implementing some of those policies into their own policy. Also, with respect to Representative Pinto's question about compliance, and I'll ask Mr. Gove to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's some sort of annual compliance review that's done of agencies and their policies. So we would make sure that there's an annual review that the agencies have in place. So again, the purpose of this is really to mandate that local law enforcement agencies do adopt a policy, and I'm also glad to hear that the phone was ringing and that they were anxious to get this policy. One of the things I think is really important about this policy is how much it stresses a victim-centered approach. And in my work as a prosecutor, you really see how some of these sexual assault cases are different. Victims who experience trauma like this react in a way that might not be expected for folks. They might remember something like the sound of a zipper. They might remember the color of the wall behind the perpetrator's head but can't describe his face. They might be staring at a clock on the wall, and so they know the exact time it happened. These are the kinds of things that trauma can do to you, and so I'm really appreciative that the policy really takes into account this experience for victim survivors. And so since we heard a lot about the policy already, if you have other questions specific to that, I would ask Mr. Gover or Chief Revering to be available to answer that. But otherwise, I would call up my testifier, Safiya Khan, from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women.
Terrific. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Khan.
Thank you.
Please give us your name and your testimony.
Chair and members of the committee, I am Safiya Khan. I'm the Director of Policy with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women.
Welcome.
Thank you. So we are a statewide coalition of 93 member programs that serve advocacy, that provide advocacy services to domestic and sexual violence victims in all 87 counties across our state. In collaboration with our partners at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, we led the charge of representing survivors' experiences and advocacy's input within the Post Board's model policy workgroup. I'm testifying today in support of House File 327, requiring law enforcement to adopt a policy for responding to and investigating sexual assaults. Over the past 18 months, there has been heightened awareness of sexual violence across our country. Star Tribune's Denied Justice series has placed a spotlight on law enforcement and the criminal justice system here in Minnesota. All of this, the Me Too movement, the Denied Justice series, this is not news to us who work with victims every day. What is new is that a public spotlight has been turned on this issue, and now we have an opportunity to make things right. While the statistics that are highlighted in the Denied Justice series about how many sexual assaults were not adequately investigated or charged or resulted in convictions are stunning, what is alarming to us is how the courageous victim survivors who shared their experiences were treated in the process. What we know from our experiences as survivors and as advocates is that justice does not simply mean a conviction or a charge. Justice means being heard, It means being believed. It means having an equal access to the criminal justice system, regardless of your criminal history or your socioeconomic status or your sex. Justice means being treated with dignity and respect, regardless of what the system can or cannot do for you. Legislation is critical in guiding our responses towards change. But we also know that the deeper, more critical work of cultural shift in how we see sexual assault will need to happen locally. And that is the work that we all need to do together. The gaps that sexual assault victims face in our communities and in our systems did not appear overnight. And we will need long-term, multifaceted approaches centered on victims' needs to close those gaps. Requiring that every law enforcement department adopt a policy to respond to and investigate sexual assaults is an important first step in the direction that we need to go. As has already been mentioned, the post-board sexual assault model policy was created after significant input from advocacy programs. The model policy offers helpful guidelines that we believe will create a foundation for effective responses for departments who currently do not have any specific policies for handling sexual assaults. The model policy is a result of thoughtful and careful discussions and feedbacks from communities across Minnesota. We know that there are many communities in our state that already have robust sexual assault and domestic abuse policies and protocols in place, from Lyon County to Itasca County to Ramsey County. Many of these were created after careful reviews of gaps, input by victim survivors, and with constant evaluation. The post-model policy was created specifically to allow the work of those local communities to continue while offering others to have a consistent baseline response. Sexual assaults are complex, and victims have varied experiences and realities. So for us in the work group, trying to standardize a response that should also take nuances into consideration was difficult, but we think we landed in a good place. Like the domestic abuse policy that our legislature mandated in 1991, the work of adapting and implementing this locally will be that of individual communities, individual law enforcement departments and advocacy programs and nurses and community members, prosecutors' offices too. It is important that we allow for that to happen because we need approaches that will work for all of Minnesota. There are differences between large cities and small cities, rural areas and tribal lands, and what is effective in St. Paul or Minneapolis will not work effectively in Duluth or on the White Earth Reservation. Solutions must work in different jurisdictions or have the ability to be tailored to the local realities. We support House File 327 because it ensures that all communities in Minnesota offer a consistent baseline response to sexual assault victims, while also allowing communities the flexibility of creating or continuing the work of the robust protocol development that meets the need of the victim and the survivors within their own communities. We would like to thank Representative Moeller and to all the co-authors for leading this legislation and to all of you for giving us the opportunity to be heard today. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Cohn. Representative Moeller?
I think just wondering if the members have any questions.
Very well. Are there any questions for the author of the bill and or the testifier? Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, are these policies, like I said, was a good start. I know in my department and a number of departments I've worked with and alongside of in my career in law enforcement, we had these policies similar to this in place 15 to 20 years ago. And I can't remember what year my county went to the Lexipool program, which is best practices, and I believe all 87 counties across the state use that. And the sexual assault policy investigation in that one is actually a lot more detailed than this policy. One of the questions I have is, How many departments across the state don't have a policy? Because I believe every department in the state has a policy on that.
Representative Mueller, it looks like you're dialing a friend.
Yeah, I'm asking Mr. Gove to come back up because I think he could probably answer that question
Super,
better than
Director
I
Director Gove, welcome back.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. I don't know that exact number as the fact that that's not data that we collect. Obviously, the about 83 of the 87 counties, give or take, have Lexapol, and Lexapol does have a model policy that is pushed out to all the sheriff's offices. So I'm aware all the larger size, medium-sized agencies have a policy, but many of the smaller ones may not, as they themselves may not investigate these that they ask for assistance from a sheriff's office or a larger municipal agency.
Ms. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, well, I work for a three-man department, and back in 1993, we had a policy on it. These policies have been around a long time, and we've worked with our victim advocacy groups over the years in developing these policy and keep changing them, making them better. Is it a good thing to put it in law? Maybe. But what happens if a department doesn't do it? There's no penalties for that.
Representative Mueller.
Yep, so that was one of the things that we, you know, were talking about doing. And it's my understanding that, you know, if there's an issue with a local law enforcement officer, then that would be addressed by that particular agency rather than the post board. And I think that's consistent with other policies that the post board has in place. So we were trying to treat this similarly to the other policies that they have in place. I don't know if Mr. Gove wants to add to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, that's true. The post board gets involved in misconduct, not judgment calls. Where we would not have all the specifics of all the hundreds, if not thousands, of investigations. And that is correct. I mean, the chief law enforcement officer, the elected sheriff, is in an excellent position with their supervisors to take a look at to the degree to which a policy is being followed. And if it's not, policies are guidelines. What is the reason? And these cases are so fact-specific and different from one another, we think they're in the very best position to make those decisions.
Representative Johnson.
I don't think that was, or Mr. Chair, that wasn't the question I asked. What happens if the department, the chief, or the sheriff decides not to have a policy? There's no penalty for that department. Or is the chief going to be suspended or removed or the sheriff removed until there's a policy in place? And what's going to happen with the rest of the department?
I think if citizens have issues with something that a department is doing, you know, there's a couple of options. A sheriff is an elected official. Chiefs of police often get their budgets set by the county board. There are places that they can go to, the chiefs of police. I saw your expression there. So there are, just with other complaints that might happen within an agency that aren't getting addressed by the agency, there are steps. Now, if we see that there is going to be a consistent pattern of not following this policy or a comparable policy, I think we could go back and look at that point as adding, you know, some type of penalty. But since we're just rolling this out now and we want to make sure that agencies have some flexibility with their policies, I think we should give it a chance to see it work.
Thank you. I believe it's a good idea to have this policy, but as I said, I believe every department in the state already has these policies in place.
And Representative Johnson, what county?
I work in Isani County.
Isani County. Very well. Representative Pinto, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I raised my hand for one issue, but I guess before I get to that, I just wanted to address Representative Johnson's point. I mean, it says the chief law enforcement officer must develop. I mean, it's a directive. I guess we generally assume that the highest law enforcement officer in a community is going to follow the law. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable, maybe a little surprised by any implication that they're not going to follow a specific law, that, you know, write in statute saying you have to do this. So we may get to a penalty, but the day we feel like we have to impose a penalty on our chief or sheriff to follow the law is, I think, a concerning day, and I suspect other folks in the committee may agree with that. So I'm going to assume that if it says you must do it, they have to do it. They will do it. And now, of course, I'm trying to remember what my question was. But before I get to it, looks like Representative Mueller has something that she wants to say, Mr. Chair, and then I'll perhaps in response to that in some way.
Yes, and actually, Mr. Gove had something to say to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, we do have in our rules that talk about applicable rules and statutes. If there's a statute that says they must have the policy, I believe it's our position that they could be called before the board to say you have a statute that's directing you something that's governed by the Pulse Board and you're not implementing it.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto, there's also the language here that speaks about how that should come about, and it's not permissive. It's a shall consult, right. With local local sexual assault counselors, domestic abuse advocates, community organizations. I think in keeping with the community-centered approach that I think that many of us want to be able to establish strongly for our public safety work in the state. But please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and so I guess that's right. It empowers the local agency to consult, make decisions. It's very community-centered. But boy, there's a lot of teeth here that I see when you've got a lot of musts and shalls. But my question is, just when I think about some of the points that have been brought up, so you have the policy, but of course, an individual officer may not follow the policy, and how does that work? And I suspect that some of the, I found certainly in reading the series that was referenced, that there's some cases where maybe what the person is doing may violate a policy, but may end up being, as was referenced, a judgment call, et cetera. And so I know there's this broader thought about training, there's other pieces, and I wondered if Ms. Kahn from the Coalition for Battered Women, I know that you all have thought a lot about kind of the bigger picture here. Can you just maybe in response to some of these questions, that this is sort of one step, but how you all, it seems to me, and from talking with you and MCBW, that this is going to be a longer term thing to change the thinking and of officers and agencies. So if you wouldn't mind commenting on that, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kahn.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Pinto, so we have had a lot of discussions within advocacy and with our law enforcement partners on this, and we don't think that this is going to solve all the issues, but as I said, just for those departments that might not have a policy, and just recognizing that policy and protocols are different things. Policy is kind of more foundational, and protocols is about how you're going to do what the policy is telling you to do. A lot of places have protocols, but not necessarily a foundational policy, which we think is important to have. But we think, you know, training is certainly a piece of it, but then also looking at how people work with their local advocacy programs in multidisciplinary team settings to do case reviews. Some of that accountability piece and making sure the policy is being followed happens within those team settings where people have discussions about this is what happened in our case, this is what we decided our policy and our protocol was going to be, did it match it or not, and then what do we need to do to change that. In addition, we've had a domestic abuse policy in the state that was, as I mentioned, mandated by the legislature in 1991, and all CSCs against family and household members, again, under Minnesota law, are defined under the domestic abuse definition. So that policy already applies to all those CSCs. So things like you have to write a police report on all domestic abuse means you have to write it on all CSCs against a family and household members. And we actually just received funding from the state for a special project in partnership with our law enforcement associations, the BCA, and with Post Board having an advisory role to look at creating some sort of tools for supervisors and management locally to look at how should they look at the evaluation of whether or not compliance is happening and what should that look like in a small agency that has five officers versus an agency that might have 40 or 50 officers or, you know, 800 for Minneapolis, what would that look like? And those, we have a lot of unanswered questions, but we are hoping that that project would answer some of them.
Thank you, Ms. Kahn.
Thank you.
Right. And, I think I'm now realizing the next bill will probably address more of where I was going with this, Mr. Chair, so I'm all done. Thank you.
Very well. I'm going to call Representative Grasso, but heads up, if there's anyone else or anyone in the public here that wishes to speak to the bill, please come forward. Meanwhile, Representative Russell.
First of all, thank you for the cookies that you brought. I only had two.
11.
Nash is trying to say 11, but it's not true. I didn't have enough coffee for 11. As a former chief of police of a small one-and-a-half officer department, that's where I started out, I made sure that I followed post policies, all the recommendations. And anything that I didn't have, I went to the local sheriff's office and looked to see what policies they had. And the chiefs of police before me made sure that we were following policies, and if we needed something for investigatory purposes, we made sure that we had the policies in place. I guess, you know, when I read through this, after listening to the testimony by Post Board, I'm looking at this and wondering, what is this legislation going to do that the Post Board policies and what law enforcement has already been doing for all these years, what is this legislation going to help in any way? You know, for one thing, is it really necessary? Because as a law enforcement officer, my goal was to make sure, and it always has been and it still is, to ensure that victims are represented to the fullest and that we exercise everything that we have at our fingertips to ensure that. So, I guess if you would answer, if you have any insight there, please.
Representative Mullen.
Yeah, Representative Grassl, thank you. And thank you for your commitment then in your past experience. But I think as the Deny Justice series revealed, and as Ms. Khan testified too about her experience as an advocate and what they're hearing from victim survivors in the field, there are problems. Things aren't, you know, maybe things were working well in your agency, but we know that there are gaps throughout the state. And so this legislation is really addressed at closing those gaps, making sure that there is a good policy in place. And, you know, like I think Ms. Khan said, it's a consistent baseline policy here with flexibility for local agencies. That's what this is really meant to achieve and to highlight the need for these victim-centered responses.
Representative Grassl.
No, thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to that, you know, when I hear the Post Board saying that the majority of these counties, what is it, 83 of the counties or police departments or whoever, all these agencies were calling in not to ask if the policy was completed to implement it, but if the policy was completed so that we can ensure that we are still in compliance. So that tells me that our agencies are out there working diligently to make sure that they have things in place, to make sure that we take care of those who are in need of help. You know, so I mean, I look at from a law enforcement position, I look at these things and I wonder, okay, if we're putting more regulations, more burden on more mandates on our officers and such, on our departments and such, is the funding going to be there to help them to implement these things? And if they're already doing these things, is it necessary? I mean, but if there's gaps, then we need to make sure that those gaps are closed. And that's, you know, again, you know, I'll say things. I've talked to you about the legislation that I have, and I'm still looking for help with that legislation from somebody. You know, so I'm trying to close some gaps that I have found that law enforcement officers have pointed out to me. So those are some things. I mean, that's, if these gaps need to be closed, then let's work on those gaps, get them closed. If we don't have to put unnecessary mandates on our people out in the field who are trying to do, who are working towards representing victims, you know, those are the types of things that I'd like to see more of. And when we have things that are circling around in our legislative pool waiting to, you know, hopefully get a hearing, then, I mean, let's if we're going to close gaps, if that's the thing that we're wanting to do, then let's start closing gaps, whether it's a little bit contentious or whether it's a difficult topic to talk about. I mean, we've heard several difficult topics throughout the beginning of this legislative year already. So anything that I have in the pipeline, it's not going to be a shock to anybody if we talk about those things. But I, you know, just to think about some of those things, you know, if we're already following it, if they're already doing the job, if they're already working hard to take care of our victims and to make sure that they're represented, you know, I guess that's kind of what I'm looking at here. I don't think it's bad. I think it's, you know, it's good ideas, and we need all the input. Just some things to keep in mind.
We do have someone from the public that wishes to speak on this issue, and so she can come forward. And meanwhile, I'll quickly call on you, Representative O'Neill. I think I have you on the list.
Thank you.
But let's make sure that we're able to hear from the public as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just directly to Representative Grossel's point, I think it's important to remember, you know, the Star Tribune did that eight-part series or so on denied justice, and they looked at a sampling of 1,300 cases across Minnesota in 20 different jurisdictions. And what they found was only about a quarter of those reported cases actually made their way to a prosecutor. When they got to the prosecutor's office, 50% of those were dropped, and they only got convictions on 7%. So I would say there's plenty of room for improvement. Something isn't going right. So this is maybe one piece of the puzzle, and maybe if we do nothing else here at the legislature but shine a light on the problem, I think that we've accomplished something. So yes, the Post Board has created this policy. They've had a great input. That's fantastic. We want agencies to adopt it, but we want agencies to actually implement it. We want them to actually do this. We want victims to actually get justice, and I think that is the greater point here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well said, Representative O'Neill. And again, I would emphasize the Chair's exhortation that community center public safety is how we're going to get there. And clearly the community's voices are being heard increasingly, as demonstrated by both Ms. Cohn's work, but also or Khan's work, but also by the media in that piece. Welcome to the committee. Look forward to hearing from you. We only have a few minutes because I do want to get on to the second bill, but please give us your name and give us your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. My name is Keila Marie Granda. I am with Unspoken Voices, a victims advocacy group out of West Central Minnesota. I am also a survivor that was featured in the Strib Denied Justice series. And I really want to reiterate what Representative O'Neill stated. I think this is a great start. I think this is amazing, and I want to say thank you for doing this. But I also want to share just a tiny bit of my experience as both a survivor and an advocate in West Central Minnesota. We have a lot of training that is available to these officers, a lot of training that is available for prosecutors. However, whether they choose to actually take that training or follow those policies that are put in place is up to each individual within those agencies. So I think we have so much room for improvement because we do have individuals who are choosing not to follow those standards. And what are the repercussions? And I think we need this. We need something that we can hold officers, we can hold agencies accountable to. But then I think we need to take it a step further at some point because there are still going to be agencies, there are still going to be individuals who are going to choose not to follow through that. As an advocate and a survivor myself, I have been on that receiving end of that experience. Officers who perhaps, you know, had some basic understanding, but in my case didn't understand what something called tonic immobility is. And in other cases didn't understand for other individuals, survivors, what disassociation was. They didn't understand that the timeline isn't linear. They didn't understand that in forensic interviewing, when it's victim-centered, that individuals may remember something, a smell. To me, I remembered the smell of garbage, but I couldn't remember exact details. Not until I was interviewed using the FETI trauma approach by an outside consulting firm was I able to start remembering some of those details. And so I think it's extremely important that training becomes more available, but then more than that, that we actually, and I don't know how to fix this, but that we actually have officers and prosecutors and judges and advocates who are willing to step up and actually take this and make it a part of their job and make it a part of what they're doing.
I also think one of the things we've talked about is, you know, we need to make it victim-centered, et cetera, but we're not really including inclusivity when it comes to marginalized communities, and that's huge. We need to be talking about inclusivity and victim-centered approaches for all genders, not just women, but for all genders, for all ages, and also for individuals with disabilities, individuals of color. That is all part of those victim-centered interview techniques, and that's something I think we need to really, just when it comes to even cultural understanding for officers, I think that's a huge piece as well. And then I also wanted to say that I'm extremely excited to hear about the bill that's going to be coming up in a few minutes. I think it's an amazing bill, and it's been great to hear a lot of the work that's been done, but something I have noticed that is missing, apart from the Deny Justice series, are the voices of the survivors themselves. And I think that's really, really important. You know, nothing about us without us. And so I really hope that moving forward, survivors can be included in this process. And I want to say thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak, and thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for the work that all of you are doing, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your work and for your testimony here today. We're going to take one more because we do want to get to that other bill. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to all of you. Representative Mueller, you know, maybe you can answer this or someone can answer this, but when was the last time that a post policy was written? You know, when was it that? Because there are policies out there, it sounds like there have been policies. I'm wondering when, do you know when the last time policy, okay. And before I even get there, because I'll make this quick, you know, I do think it's important after years to revisit policies like this. So I do see the need for creating a working group to look at this again.
Indeed, Representative Christensen, we have a living legislature that responds to a living society. And so we constantly should be reflecting and adjusting our laws accordingly. Director Gove, I think you've been dialed again.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christensen, prior to me starting, I believe it was 2010, and it involved the administrative forfeiture. But unless you're asking me about this particular, well, the board has not written a model policy on sexual assault until the current one before you.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Chair Johnson,
on this,
question,
on this issue. Representative Chair Marriott, Chair Representative Christensen, in my department and the departments throughout the state that use the LexiPool program for model policy, those are continually monitored and updated almost on a daily basis. They're continually looking out for the best practices, what works. If they find something that doesn't working or because of statutes have changed, they adjust those policies to match the current statutes and also what works best. And I believe the cities app, they have a different program a lot of cities use. They are also changing and updating daily as to what works best to make sure that, especially in these cases on sexual assaults, they're actually, I believe they're actually a harder investigation than a homicide. They're very difficult to put together. That's why in my department, we worked collaboratively with the victim services, with the county attorney's office, with investigations, with patrols, with other agencies that might have information to put the best case together so the county attorneys can prosecute.
Very well.
Thank you, Representative
Mueller. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I echo the voices of many of my colleagues, both sides of the aisle here in that regard. I look forward to us continuing this conversation when we, as we move throughout the session. At this point, the chair is going to lay this bill on the table for possible inclusion into our omnibus bill. And with that, Representative Mueller, we also have your bill, House File 418. And I think I'm going to get this correct here, that your motion is that this bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Did I get that right?
Yes, I think that sounds correct.
So, Representative Mueller so moves. Representative Mueller, bill House Bill 418 is before us.
All right, thank you.
Representative Mueller, you have a delete all amendment, the DE2 amendment. Is it your intent to move that amendment at this time?
It is not, Mr. Chair. At this point, we will not be moving the delete all amendment, so we'll just be working off the original House File 418.
Very well. Then House File 14 is before us as introduced. Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members. And this really is just, these things that we're talking about really are just the beginning of the conversation here. And one of the things that I think is really important as we're moving forward and how we can best address sexual assault issues in the state is to look at our criminal sexual conduct statutes. The purpose of this bill is to create a working group to really examine how our criminal sexual conduct statutes are working or not working and look at rewriting all of those statutes. And to talk a little bit about why this is necessary, over the years, the statute has been amended time and time again. Even the last couple of hearings, we've heard about some of the situations that aren't covered by statute, which we think should be covered, whether or the exclusions like marital rape, touching a clothed buttocks, a teacher's having sex with 18-year-old students. Representative Miller, you made a point at the hearing the other day about you hated the loopholes in these cases. And it seems like we're just constantly fixing these loopholes. And what happens is, as a result, these statutes have become very unwieldy. With sexual contact, there are three separate definitions of sexual contact, depending on what kind of charging provision you're using. It's gotten very complicated. And when we're just coming back and trying to close these loopholes, it seems that we are denying victims justice and we're not holding offenders accountable. And this, here's another loophole I wanted to explain to you. So the Minnesota Supreme Court in December of 2018 issued a decision in the Ortega-Rodriguez case. And in that case, they reversed a first-degree criminal sexual conduct conviction involving the abuse of a 10-year-old over the course of several months. And the court held that the statute required that penetration occur and that the genital contact to genital contact was not enough, that there actually had to be penetration. And so that highlights yet another loophole in our law. I'm working on legislation to address that issue. But it also shows the broader concern of cases that I've seen as a prosecutor, especially in child sexual abuse cases, where we're asking children to describe if there's contact or penetration. And for children to be able to know that that happened or articulate that is extremely difficult. And a lot of our laws make us ask children these kinds of detailed questions. So that's just one example of an area that I think really needs to be looked at. And I have several testifiers here that are going to talk about some of the changes. Sherry Townsend, if you want to come up, is a prosecutor. I've worked with her for a number of years, and she's got a lot of knowledge on this issue.
Very well. Representative Mueller, we may want to ask, why don't we ask the others to come up and be at least nearby, because we're going to be a little bit pressed
for
time. I want to make sure we maximize
that. That would be great. The other testifiers are Lindsay Bryce from Mincasa. We've got Asma Mohammed from Reviving Sisterhood, and Megan Ariala, who is a survivor. And I just wanted to make a note about survivors. I did let some organizations know that our committee is always wanting to hear from victim and survivors. And so the mic is always open to hear about these cases. We really appreciate Ms. Granda coming and talking to us today. We want to hear your voices. And so any of these bills that we're discussing, and I think I speak on behalf of my other committee members as well, please always feel free to share those concerns with us. And thank you for coming, Ms. Granda.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Again, consistent with the community-centered approach to public safety. Ms. Townsend, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here. My name is Sherry Townsend, as Representative Mueller indicated, and I'm a prosecutor with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'm currently a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I supervise child abuse prosecutions in addition to vulnerable adult prosecutions and have a trial team as well. It has been my privilege over the years working in Hennepin County to be able to work with any number of survivors of sexual assault, be it both adult and child survivors. I have worked at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office as a prosecutor for 7 years. I've been working as a prosecutor for 20 years total, including working at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office and the Dakota County Attorney's Office. So all told, in my years of experience, I've had so many opportunities and privileges to work with numerous victims of sexual assault and to navigate some of the statutory issues that we have with sexual assault cases. I would note that Representative Moeller asked that I be here today to talk a little bit about just a couple of experiences that I've had as a prosecutor dealing with some of the legislative challenges that there are in relation to the bill that she has proposed to do a full review of those. And I have two circumstances that I'd like to just speak with the committee about today in general. First of all, I'd like to just speak about the issue that Representative Moeller just talked about with the Ortega Rodriguez case that was just recently decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court. As this committee may be aware, the definition in cases involving criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, conduct that involves sexual penetration is penalized, in addition to conduct involving children under the age of 13 when it is bare genital-to-genital contact. And my understanding of that legislation, that the addition of the bare genital-to-genital contact, was that many years ago that legislation went through because of the experiences that children have, certainly children under the age of 13, in describing penetration. As Representative Moeller indicated, as prosecutors, we are often in the position of having to talk with the most vulnerable of survivors about the most difficult and challenging of experiences that they have. Particularly with children, it presents a challenge because children are placed in a position to describe acts that they should never have to know about in the first place. And certainly the issue of sexual penetration is an extremely difficult circumstance for a child of any age to describe, but certainly as the legislation reflects, the age of 13 or under the age of 13, to describe what that means, certain body parts and how those body parts were involved in what happened to them is very difficult. So that legislation where it describes first degree criminal sexual conduct can involve not only penetration, but bare genital to genital contact is extraordinarily helpful for prosecuting cases involving children under the age of 13. The issue that presented itself, and certainly I think in the Ortega Rodriguez decision, was that portions of that statute, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, only reference sexual penetration and do not specifically indicate that included in that would be the bare-to-bare genital contact if the victim is under 13. So it is my belief, and I believe Representative Moeller's bill, to make sure that there is a review of the statutes to fix any of those issues as it relates to whether the definition or the conduct that is penalized specifically permits, as I say in the CSC 1 statute, both sexual penetration or bare-to-bare genital contact is also covered. And so that is a circumstance where I know that was a prosecution, I believe in Ramsey, where that happened, but where the statute, because it only said sexual penetration for that portion that the case was prosecuted under and the conduct was bare genital-to-genital contact, a fix of that legislation would be extraordinarily helpful for us to avoid any future circumstances such as that. As I've indicated, I've had the privilege to speak with numerous children who have alleged and who have been victimized of sexual assault, and the language in the statute that prohibits and makes that criminal sexual conduct in the first degree is something that we, the genital-to-genital contact, is something that we deal with on a fairly regular basis in our child abuse cases in Hennepin County, and I know counties throughout the state of Minnesota, many of whom I get to work with in our capacities as child abuse prosecutors and sexual assault prosecutors. As it relates to another example of a case where a review of the legislation and to take maybe amendments that were put in and not necessarily contemplated and working together is the sexual contact statutes, specifically sexual contact in the second degree, criminal sexual conduct in the second degree, and in the fourth degree, where the prohibition is against sexual contact. A case example that Representative Mueller and I spoke about that I've experienced was a circumstance where we were prosecuting an individual who sexually assaulted a woman who was not conscious at the time. And the allegation of the sexual assault involved his genitalia to her mouth area. And she was not conscious for the sexual assault. She did not know that it was actually happening at the time it was happening. Because the case was, at least initially, largely circumstantial, we did charge a criminal sexual contact in the fourth degree, believing that because she was physically helpless, the definition of sexual contact contemplated the perpetrator's intimate parts against the complainant's non-intimate parts. But what we found is that the definition of sexual contact at subdivision 11 of 609341, it has two separate definitions of sexual contact, and one of the definitions applies to certain provisions of the statute, and the definition that dealt with our particular conduct did not apply to the physically helpless provision. It only applied to certain subdivisions not included in the set of facts that we had. So that was an example that immediately leapt to mind as Representative Mueller was talking about the possible review of sexual assault statutes and trying to see what, if any, reconciliation of any amendments or changes that had happened over the years, how that could impact or how that could be effective. This is my closest example of a circumstance where the statute did not permit us to prosecute the individual for sexual contact because the definition of sexual contact was not applicable to his conduct if the victim was physically helpless at the time. We certainly were able to prosecute the individual for criminal sexual conduct in the third degree and attempted criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. So we were successful in our prosecution, but that certainly was an issue that presented itself for charges that we believed would be applicable to that particular case. So I appreciate very much the opportunity to come and just highlight a couple of examples of circumstances that, as a prosecutor who's been doing these cases for several years, I welcome a review of the sexual assault statutes and reconciling any issues or differences in definitions that may or may not impact future prosecutions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney Townsend, for helping to highlight some examples of why the importance of reviewing our state sexual assault laws as they apply to the ability of our prosecutors to pursue justice equitably and fairly for victims. We have Representative Mueller about 5 minutes, so but let's get in as much testimony as we can, and then we'll proceed forward.
Sure. I'm going to turn it over to Lindsay Bryce right now from NCASA. If you could just quickly summarize this, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for inviting me here again today. I've been in front of you. This is the second time this week. I was actually supposed to be here yesterday as well. My name is Lindsay. Pardon?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My name is Lindsay Bryce. I'm the Law and Policy Director at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I'm going to skip what I think everybody here knows what MnCASA is, so I'm going to skip through that. But I'm here to speak in support of this bill and to thank Representative Mueller, co-authors, and yourself, Mr. Chair, for advancing this conversation. Just briefly, MnCASA does fairly substantial policy work, and we have a policy committee that consists of representatives from member programs, allies, criminal justice system professionals, victim survivors, and others. We break that committee down into multiple subcommittees, and our Access to Justice subcommittee has historically had substantial prosecution input and involvement. And we have spent, both that committee and our Victim Services Subcommittee has spent substantial time over the last years working on exactly this issue. What different segments of this statute are problematic and need to be fixed? You've heard, just this week, you've heard two different bills that came out of that work. You've heard about voluntary relationships and how problematic that statute is. And you've heard about the problems within the Buttocks bill. And you discussed a bill that would amend that statute to define the intentional touching of clothed buttocks as criminal. Some of where that came from is out of MnCASA's policy work. So we've been receiving a strong message from advocacy programs, specifically in victims and survivors, that there are a number of problems within these statutes. Most recently, we've been having a number of conversations around the prosecution or lack thereof of alcohol and other substance-related incidents in sexual assault cases. So we started running through our usual process and working within our policy committees and subcommittees on that language, the physically helpless and mental incapacitation language. In fact, if you've seen our agenda, you'll see some specific mental incapacitation language suggested in there. However, we've come to the conclusion that a comprehensive approach of this entire statute is really the way to go because there are so many different problems. Now, I say that, however, I still want you to support the other two bills that you heard this week because that has been through substantial vetting already, so we're further along in that process. But instead of continuing to do this piecemeal, we're asking you to pass the pieces that we've already done and then pass a bill that allows us to really comprehensively do some multidisciplinary work with an intentional focus on meaningful input from victims and survivors and marginalized communities and some of the folks that are most impacted. And this is a priority for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Price.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Asma Muhammad, and I am the Advocacy Director at Reviving the Islamic Sisterhood for Empowerment. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for inviting me. So at Reviving Sisterhood, we convene healing circles for survivors of sexual violence. It's just one of the many things we do. But in that, we have learned a lot, and part of those learnings have been that survivors need to lead the way. So in that, I am a survivor myself, and just this past December, I shared that I was assaulted when I was 12. So that was just over a month ago. And afterwards, five women from the Muslim community, all women of color, reached out to me and said that the same man had assaulted them. It's been 15 years, and I've just become comfortable enough to talk about this. And now the statute of limitations does not protect me. I have no way to report this. None of those women can report this. So that man thrived off of our silence and knowing that most children don't talk in the very beginning, right? So in talking about this statute, in convening like a survivor-led approach and by prosecutors who've dealt with survivors, I think is super important because we are reminding everyone that survivors have the trauma that they've experienced is the center of all of this. That is where the legislation should come from. So, of course, I also support many of the bills that have been coming through this committee over the past few days and some that will come next week. But if we hold some kind of convening, if we have this working group, we're going to allow for some of that to happen, I think, in a way that is hearing survivors' voices. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mohammed. Thank you for coming forward and for asserting your dignity publicly.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, my name is Megan Adiola. I'm 25 years old, a lawyer, a House of Representatives employee, so you'll see me around. I'm also a survivor of rape and domestic violence. As a result of this, I struggle every single day with the after effects of PTSD, depression, and anxiety. I am proudly open about my decision to manage these illnesses with medication, with antidepressants, and through the medical marijuana program that the state recently enacted PTSD as a pre-existing condition, and I am so grateful every single day for that. I spend more than 50 hours a week on top of my full-time job running an online support group for rape and sexual violence survivors. We currently have approximately 1,500 members from across the United States and a few international members as well. I speak to high school students at private Catholic high schools about the importance of consent, healthy relationships, and healthy sexuality. I do all of this unpaid in addition to my full-time job because I feel the need to provide the services and information that was lacking when I was grappling with the after effects of my rape. I was assaulted when I was 17 by a boyfriend. When I got to law school, it broke my heart to learn when I studied criminal law that my rape would not have been prosecutable. Even though I was 17 when it happened and the statute of limitations on my crime only expired in December of 2018, I knew that reporting would be fruitless because our current laws and our current societal attitudes toward survivors would not let me receive systemic justice. I've received justice in other ways by speaking out, by telling my story, and by providing support to other survivors. But for many survivors, that's not enough. They need justice in the system. If I had reported when I was 17 and when this first happened, I learned quickly in law school from my professors, my classmates, and through statutes and previous decisions, what I would have faced when I had reported. Questions about why I didn't scream, why I didn't tell someone sooner, why I continued to date him after he raped me. I had consented to vaginal sex immediately before he sodomized me, and that would have been viewed as consent to all sexual activity under current interpretations of the meaning of consent. Statements like, how could you have known you didn't want it? How could he have known you didn't want it? You were already naked. What did you think would have happened? These types of victim-blaming questions are still being asked of survivors to this day when they find the courage to report. When I say I hear from survivors every single day, I mean it. I hear from hundreds of survivors in our group. Every time I think I've heard it all, some new way that a person has been sexually violated comes across my screen. So many of these traumas cannot be prosecuted for a number of reasons. Police departments across the country and across the globe are simply lacking the violence about how trauma affects people, who can commit sexual violence, and who can be a victim of sexual violence. What a victim survivor will need from their reporting officer in order for their story to be told is crucial. I don't blame individual police officers. I don't blame individual judges or individual lawyers. They hurt to hear every single time these questions are asked, but they reflect a societal misconception about sexual violence and trauma that is pervasive in our system. I'm not so blinded by my passion for this subject that I don't recognize that all crimes are not prosecutable. No matter the type of crime, sometimes the investigation just does not provide enough to support a criminal charge. But what law enforcement agencies can do is to strive to not re-traumatize the victims when they report. Just because a case does not move forward in the courts doesn't mean that a victim survivor was lying, and that should be treated as such. It costs exactly $0 to treat a trauma survivor with respect, so I hope that's reflected in the fiscal note for this bill. That was a joke. As you heard from the experts on this subject, statistics and what we need from survivors don't lie. There's a fundamental misunderstanding about sexual violence in our country's criminal justice system. I believe that under the dutiful advisement of groups like MnCASA, RISE, and the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, this working group can do some concrete good. Putting together in one place representatives of all the types of groups where a victim survivor may seek help will be a meeting of the minds unlike any that Minnesota has seen for this subject. This exchange of information, expertise, and stories of impact like mine is a valuable currency that cannot be undervalued. Working groups like this one will put Minnesota on the forefront of a national call for reform around sexual violence laws. We can lead the way to be an example of respect, belief, and equal justice under the law for others. I'm not an expert in this field. I'm not a certified professional, a stakeholder, or an elected official. I'm just a survivor speaking out of love for the survivors I support every single day. And I ask you to consider the good that this working group will do for Minnesota survivors today and in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Adeola. Thank you for asserting your power and your dignity here today.
Thank you.
Members, we are past our time of adjournment. My understanding is there is no committee here. We have floor session in about, 20, 25 minutes. The chair is certainly willing to entertain a few more minutes if you have questions or comments that you wish to offer at this time for Representative Moeller, and then we'll move forward. Yes, please, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Just a really quick comment because somebody talked about statute of limitations. And as we had talked, I think, offline sometime this week, it was a really full week, so I don't remember which day. But I'm very excited that when I do bring my bill back, it has a component of eliminating the statute of limitations. And so, and maybe Maybe they still can't go to court because you still need to prove it in a court of law, beyond a reasonable doubt. But I think it gives some dignity back to those that were victimized and realize that those cases do matter, your trauma does matter. And I think, you know, when you talk about what you just said, of there's five victims that you know of, you can put those together and actually come up with a case now. And so I'm really excited to bring that forward whenever we bring that back up, Mr. Chair, with the Hannah bill. And so I just get excited when they say things like that. I'm like, I have a bill for that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator O'Neill, I look forward to the hearing on Hannah's bill. Other members? Anyone else that wishes to comment on the bill? Then Representative Mueller, you get the last word here.
All right. Well, I don't have anything more to say than what these all the testifiers had to say, and I just want to thank them again for coming, for having the courage to not only have your voice be heard, but to help so many other people along the way. We really appreciate it, and we hope to see you again a lot throughout this process. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. I do believe this is what community-centered public safety is all about. So with that, Representative Mueller renews her motion that House File 418, I want to make sure I get this right, House File 418 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mueller, and I look forward to seeing this bill as it journeys its way back to our division. Members, thank you so much, and until next week, this committee stands adjourned.